And then the whole process of converting fat into milk.
Yes.
Which is the other thing that's happening. And if you think about it, like our average litter size, it was 2.3 was our average litter size.
Okay.
So basically in between 2 and 3.
That checks out with what I see in the spring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're raising, so they're giving up from their body enough milk, enough fluid to bring these cubs up to the weight of 8 pounds, say, on the average.
Wow.
For at least two of them.
Sure.
Might be a little bit less if they've got three. But that's just an incredible exchange of energy converting from fat into high-protein milk.
Yeah. Not just turning fat into like a heat exchange of energy, but also the liquid element of that too.
Yep.
It's so amazing. Like, what an incredible animal.
Yeah, they
really
are.
What an incredible animal.
Yeah, and of all the wildlife research I've done in 35, 40 years, I would say without question, the most amazing animal is the female bear.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast.
Four years ago, I bought a new truck for the first time ever, and I was so excited. It was incredible. It smelled good. It felt good. I wasn't constantly afraid of breaking down. You know, it was awesome. But after I drove it for a couple of weeks, I do the same thing that I always do. And the backseat started to fill up with stuff. You know, I'm guiding elk hunters and deer hunters, and I'm duck hunting and I'm fly fishing, and all that gear just accumulates. And pretty soon I wasn't able to take people with me anymore. And I was embarrassed. You know, people would ask for a ride and like, nah, sorry, man, I've got too much stuff with me. But I couldn't put it in the bed because then it gets damaged by weather. So I go to the internet and I'm looking for options, and I ended up buying a deck to drawer system. Now, this was a big purchase for me, but it's something that I felt like I needed, and it looked like it was going to be a good product, and it really was. Dekt came out with a new drawer system this year, and they've made some meaningful improvements over the previous one. You have almost no wasted space in your truck bed now, so you can access the sides of the drawers, and then the drawers roll a full 18 inches farther out, so you can actually access the back of the drawer even if you don't have a lot of arm reach. There's some really strong tie down points on top that have a 400 pound load rating, so if you're going to haul something like a motorcycle or big coolers or whatever, you can really strap your gear down and make it secure. You can lock these drawer systems, so you can lock the drawers, or if your tailgate locks, then nobody can access the drawers anyways. So I actually feel like my stuff is more secure inside this drawer system than in the cab of my truck. That's a big deal to me. The complete deck system is made in America by Americans, and you know that that's something that I love and appreciate. They've got one that will fit in any truck or van that's been made in America in the last 20 years plus. You can go to dekt.com/sixranch and get free shipping. But just being honest with you, they get free shipping to everybody. I also, while you're there, want you to check out their deco line. So they've got a bunch of different boxes and storage containers that either fit on top of or inside of the drawer system, and those are built really robust. I saw the prototypes at an event this summer. I'm impressed. I'm excited to get my hands on them. I haven't yet, but the prototypes were super badass, and the ones that are in production model, they're available now over at dekt.com. So even if you just need a place for some tools, or you need a new bow case, or you know, something along those lines, go check that out. And if you're driving around right now and your backseat is just full of gear and you can't haul people around, maybe you should consider looking at the full deck drawer system, because it's a good piece of gear. It was a good purchase for me, and I hope it helps you. Now, this studio is kind of fun. It's very soundproof. And when I was researching how to do that, it's not all that easy, but I have insulation in the walls that's blow-in insulation. And then this is just wall tent canvas over the top of that.
Thought it looked like that.
Yeah. And yeah, it kind of has a like a hunting lodge feel.
Oh, it does. Yeah. It's great. Yeah. Or like being in a big wall tent.
Right. Which I love. I love being in wall tents.
Yeah, I do too.
I like the smell of it. I like the feel of it. Whatever you're doing in a wall tent, it's probably a thing worth doing.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. We lived in them for several winters in Idaho.
Yeah. So did you do anything to insulate them when you were living in them throughout the
winter?
Just
kept the fire going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's enough, right?
It is.
If the fire's going, it's warm.
Yeah.
If the fire's out, it's not.
It's not.
Yeah.
It cools off real quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had one camp that would frequently be 15 to 20 below, and we always had double sleeping bags for that one.
Yeah.
And or we would be on a schedule where every couple hours somebody would stoke the fire.
Right.
And we had the best stove there, too.
What kind of stove was it?
You know, they're the Cabela's packing-type stoves, and this one was, I think it's called the Packer stove. This one was a little different. It had a tight door. It was not a Cabela's. We had like four or five different camps that we'd work between.
Okay. What was travel like to get between the camps?
On muleback.
Okay.
Primarily. Although, you know, you ended up walking and leading the mules, to be honest.
Do you need a different saddle for a mule than you do for a horse just because of the difference in their anatomy?
Yeah, we have. It's got a little narrower tree.
Okay.
That's the main feature. Of course, you can find that in old-style Western saddles, too.
When all the horses were starving to death?
Yeah, all the horses were thoroughbred, starving to death, and the cowboys were built the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. We have an old Hamley saddle. It's, I think, 1913 vintage. And it does, it's even narrow for some of our mules.
Is it?
Because our mules, you know, we've used them three-way, driving, packing, and riding. So they actually do the best with a quarter horse saddle, to be honest.
My friend Greg Jones builds saddle trees, really nice saddle trees, in Adrian, Oregon. And I've been trying to get him to start making them with a CNC machine or make them out of carbon fiber.
Yeah.
You know, modernize that process a little bit. And there's so much reluctance to change technology for
saddles.
For horse tack.
Oh, incredible.
It's amazing to me that, and, you know, if you were to make a saddle with modern technology today, it probably will not be around in 100 years, like the Hamley saddle that you're talking about.
Right.
But in the short term, it could perform at a much higher level.
And it would flex, too. And I think that... You know, there's the OrthoFlex trees and OrthoFlex components that now are kind of doing what you're talking about.
Sure.
And it's probably better for the animals in the long haul.
Well, you could make the thing 20 pounds lighter, probably.
Yeah.
You know, that's significant, too, especially for all these speed events that people are doing.
Oh, I know it. Yeah. I tend to use roping saddles because ultimately I end up packing my riding saddles.
Yeah.
With meat or whatever,
right.
Usually camp gear because the pack saddles are getting the meat.
Yeah.
But when there is meat, I should say.
Oh, there's meat.
Yeah, that's right. Anymore.
Well, I mean, you're a bow hunter, so
I've got friends I help rifle hunt. That's right. Not much meat.
Oh, I'm giving you a hard time.
Although it's amazing how many hunters up the Big Sheep Wing Ridge country know where my camp is.
Uh-huh.
And I've told some of them, you know, you shoot something up there. I've got the mules. If I'm not tied up, I'll give you a hand.
Yeah.
So they'll come and, are you there this year?
Yeah. You the know. Backcountry Uber.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something that I have thought about within pack saddles specifically, I do love ropes and I love knots and I always have. You know, I can sit with a piece of string and just tie knots for a long time and
be
very, very content with that. However, I see real application in changing the way we tighten gear to an animal, whether that's with ratchet straps or some of our things that can pull up tension and have some flex and still add tension. Like there's just There's so many things we have available now that are better than a hemp rope and a diamond hitch.
Right. Yeah. And I went away from hemp rope probably 30 years ago, as soon as the lineman's ropes started to become available. And although I can get things untied pretty quick because just muscle memory.
Yeah.
You know what to do. I might fumble around with a ratchet strap.
Yeah.
Although I won't say I haven't used a ratchet strap to secure a top pack in between the rings.
I think that I have. There's real application for that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I like webbing a lot when I'm lashing stuff down, especially on boats, because it doesn't stretch.
Right.
You know, however tight it is how tight it's going to stay, whether it's hot or cold or wet or dry.
And you've got a kind of a gripping effect as well. Yeah.
But
no, it's all good.
There's good that comes with tradition and that reluctance.
Yeah.
And then there's also, you know, this thought that, are we just dragging an anchor? And
Well, and some people are just, quite frankly, never going to put the time in to become proficient with all the various hitches that are safety oriented.
Yeah.
The hitches themselves, be it a diamond hitch or whatever, quick release knots, you name it.
Yeah. I was team box hitch.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I lived. I never got fancy.
Yeah, I've done box hitches too. You know, you do this for 40 years, pretty soon, if you do a lot, you've pretty much experimented with them all.
Yeah.
And it's like, they're all good. They all have their specific application. But I like hang-on pannier bags with a top pack. I use a tipped-up basket hitch. Mm-hmm. It's simple.
Yeah.
And I can get my saw out quick or whatever. And it seems like as years go by, you kind of get into simple and quick.
Yeah.
And
I've got a quick mule anecdote, and then we'll leave packing behind because that's not what we're here to talk about today. But you know, I talked with Cliff Gray this fall and asked him about his worst mule he ever had. He was running over 50 head for a big outfit in Colorado. And I can't remember what the mule's name was, but he talked about this mule. And he told me that he'd gotten rid of it. Well, I had three other outfitters write me and say, I think we ended up with that mule. So it was just trading hands and outfits and getting sold or given away. It's like a cheap mule.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, it's either in Montana alive or it's in Montana dead at this point. Yeah.
It's probably buried in Montana.
Could be. You know. Yeah. Grizzly bait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I was guiding for this outfitter on Big Creek in 1990, the outfitter, he was a character, Jerry Jepson, and he always called me Pard. He called everybody Pard. He said, Pard, you're going to get the rough string. And I said, oh, great.
Awesome.
Thanks, Jerry. And he says, you know how to deal with mules. A lot of my guides don't.
Yeah.
I said, okay. All right. We'll make it work. Well, there was about three mules like the one you're talking about that I think had been passed around by the various outfitters because they were culls.
Yep.
And ultimately, we were packing out this elk and during a thunderstorm. And
just an ideal scenario.
Yeah. And my helper, he was also a guide, assistant guide first year. He couldn't get his rain jacket off this mule, the riding saddle. And I said, well, hey, don't do it, Bob.
Just get wet.
Yeah, just get wet. I said, I wish I would have left it at that. But he was getting wet and he looked miserable. And I said, let me try it. So I went to the shoulder and I reached around and I just shifted a little bit and that mule sensed I was out of position. It reached forward and wham, knocked my knee out of joint.
Yep.
And man, I tell you, that rough string stuff is not the way to go. I learned that.
Well, and that's not a place you want to be with a dislocated knee.
Fortunately, this guy was amazing. His dad had been a Hell's Angel in San Francisco. Hmm. He had grown up in a Hell's Angel environment.
Okay.
He was big and strong.
Yeah.
He didn't know about hunting. Ultimately became, I think, one of Idaho's premier guides. Hmm. But that guy was strong. He weighed about 240. He did everything that needed to be done.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had to tell him a few things, but he just took charge. He picked me up and he put me on the good mule.
Yeah.
And we got up out of there a bit. It was pretty impressive. And it was in a hole.
Yeah.
And it's one of those bad experiences.
Yeah.
And,
but There you are now.
Yeah.
You're still out there chasing chuckers down on the hillside.
Yeah. A little bit of a bum knee, but I live with it.
Yeah.
So,
well, we're here to talk about bears. So on the show last week, we talked about the urbanization of black bears in the Tahoe Basin, which is so fascinating and interesting to me. And the more I've thought about it since having that conversation with 2G, I really sincerely believe that where bears are at currently in that Tahoe area is the step right before domestication. If I were to imagine how a wolf becomes a dog that lives in a camp, this is the progression, right? And the stage that they're at there is when they're relocating those bears, the bears either come back to where they were or they starve to death trying to get there. So they're not able to eat on their own without having that human food source. And that dependency, I think, ultimately results in either we've got to kill all these bears or kill bears constantly, or bears become pets and they become part of our lives.
Right. And that latter scenario, I don't think is workable.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's been enough evolutionary time for that to work. You know, you threw out the analogy of a dog, and that occurred over thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at something that's pretty quick track.
Yeah.
There's going to be some individuals that probably would be not disruptive to human activities.
Right.
But the majority at some point are going to revert back to their instincts. You know, I need to dig into that building in order to get that food item, sort of a thing.
We were looking through all the skulls in the studio here and talking about relative brain size. Mm-hmm. And bears' relative brain size is actually tremendous.
Yeah.
So if we look across mammals, bears end up right there with the great apes. And they are an incredibly intelligent animal and one of the most adaptive out there. And I think that both of those things could lend themselves towards sort of an accelerated evolution.
You got a good point. Yeah, probably more so than the dog,
maybe
the wolf.
Yeah.
Because if you look at those skulls, really analyze them, I think if you measured the cranial capacity, it would be the highest for the bear in that group you have up there, with the exception of the river otter.
With the exception of the river otter.
Yeah. Proportionally.
Yeah. You know. And river otters are a very interesting animal. I'll have to do an otter show at some point. I don't enjoy the role they take ecologically.
Yeah.
I'm pretty anti-otter for what they do, but what a cool animal.
Yeah.
I mean, they're an incredibly efficient killer. They're so fast and agile in the water and on land. They're absolutely vicious.
Yep.
They're playful. They're violent and aggressive. Yep. Like all the mustelids are fascinating, but I think the river otter, the badger, the wolverine, you know, those are some really charismatic mustelids, but wow, are they interesting.
Yeah, they are. And to live in that riverine environment.
Right.
Where they're dependent upon, well, pretty diversified diet.
Sure.
You know, they eat a lot of mussels, but they also catch steelhead, salmon.
Yeah.
Cutthroat trout, whitefish, etc.
Yeah. And, you know, they have an interesting relationship here on the Six Ranch with the eagles.
Yeah.
So, you know, the otters, especially when our steelhead are in, are oftentimes just grabbing those steelhead, eating the brain out of them and leaving them on the bank or leaving them in the river.
Yeah.
And the eagles are benefiting from that in a really significant way. So if I go beneath one of the bald eagle nests, it's just a graveyard of steelhead carcasses.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those, they are getting as, like, I don't know, leftovers from the otters.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all that's interesting. I think what's more interesting is bears. And you did a tremendous bear study here in Northeast Oregon. Tell me about it. Like, how did it start? What was the question?
Well, the question was basically driven by a pending legislative action, which ultimately led to the voters of Oregon deciding if there was going to be hound hunting done on both black bears and cougars.
Okay.
And Oregon was running deficient on information, particularly population information, on those two species. I was working on the Catherine Crick cougar study based out of Le Grand in between 1990 and 93.
Okay.
And ODFW leadership, the commission, was catching wind that there was this ballot measure developing, which ultimately became Measure 18, to have the voters decide on would there be hound hunting allowed for cougars and bears. The department realized they needed data fast. So we had pretty good cougar information from that Catherine Crick study and a paired study that was going on out of Roseburg in the southwest part of the state. Mm-hmm. They weren't quite as deeply into it at that time in the Roseburg area as we were out of Le Grand. But we had good data on cougars, but we still were behind on bears.
Yeah.
So we took our crew, our field crew, which involved multiple houndsmen, primarily Ted Craddock as the lead houndsman, and a lot of his houndsman friends, to move from doing research on cougars right into bears.
Is this 1990?
This is 1993.
93.
This is when we started the black bear study.
Okay.
And recall, the Measure 18 vote occurred in 94.
Right. That's so pretty rickety for getting data turned into actual science.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The only thing that I guess worked in our favor was we were highly experienced at capture handling animals and trees. So we just basically took our nets, our climbing equipment, and we moved from a cougar study where we caught and marked over 100 cougars to initiating this bear project using dogs as the primary method. We did do a little bit of snaring, particularly early on, but we felt we were running too high of a injury rate with the snares.
Were you snaring lions or bears?
Bears. And
so you're foot snaring them.
Foot snaring them.
A stopper.
And our study area was the Starkey unit. And it's a real mix of, as you know, of national forest land, of private ranches. And when we were adjacent to private ranches, we felt, let's try and snare so we don't have a loud, active dog capture program going on private property where we obviously would need to get permission before going there.
Yeah.
So we were kind of using the snare aspect to manage around the periphery of where we could really operate with the dogs.
Were they power snares?
They're Aldrich snares, spring
activated.
And we had some success with them. There's no question.
Yeah, they'll catch stuff.
Yeah. And
they're
very
effective. Yeah.
We did. The issue is the amount of time that the bears in the snare affects what they do to themselves because they're going to struggle. We had one male bear, good size bear, 250, 280 pound, take the drag tree 30 feet up a tree.
Oof.
So, you know, we're talking about a log being towed behind this bear as it climbs up this tree.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it had come back down, but, you know, there's leg damage that results from that. So we just switched to just using the hounds and our aerial capture program where we would dart them and drop them into a net and or I or an assistant would climb up and put a line around them and lower them. But if you're going to do that, it's kind of nice to climb a tree with a double-layered trampoline-style device underneath you for safety purposes.
Now, what chemical restraint were you using? Was it Telazol?
We were using Telazol.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was primarily. We used Capturol 5, which is a ketamine-xylazine mix early on, and it worked okay, but Telazol just seemed a little smoother, and they would come out of the drug a little better is what it amounted to.
And did you see the people that were taking xylazine? That does bad stuff to people.
Yeah. Telazol actually was a pretty smooth drug, and we used that for most of our mobilizations.
Well, and my understanding is that you just about can't overdose them on Telazol.
That could be. They start to aspirate.
Yeah.
They get foam coming out their mouth, I think, if you don't roughly get the dose about right.
Yeah.
And certain individuals will, but, and we would usually let the bear rest in the tree before we darted it. So respiration was down and temperature was down.
And this is all sounding a little bit hostile, but the reality is, there's always some casualties in animal capture, but the vast majority, they leave very much unharmed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Would you say that that's true? You've done a lot more of this than I have.
Yeah. Yeah. We did 157 immobilization captures.
On bears.
On bears. And we lost 4 individuals.
Not bad.
So, yeah, we were within an acceptable amount. You know, you want to be under 5% mortality. And
yeah,
we were well below that.
Yeah. So ethically, you felt good about what you were doing and how you were doing it.
Yeah. And the population was robust. The Starkey unit had a known, good, healthy, diversified age structure population. So we didn't feel we were doing any
harm. How do you age a bear without killing it?
You pull a premolar tooth, which we would do while we had it immobilized.
Yep.
And then we would send that to a lab, and they would cut a longitudinal cross-section. So you count the rings, similar to the rings on a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not exact, probably, but it's pretty darn good for bracketing.
Yep.
You know, is it in between a 9 and a 12-year-old? And it seems to me like we felt that those ages we were getting made a lot of sense. We had one female bear that was 22 and still was producing cubs.
Yeah.
So that's well above it's actually at the far end of the range of reproductive effectiveness for bears, 22 years old.
Yeah, that's an incredible thing for a wild animal that lives a tough life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then once we had, we radio collared, we actually actively monitored, I think it was 62 bears over the course of the study. And it was 31 males and 31 females.
Hmm.
So we had an exact match on that. The majority of those females gave birth to cubs. So we went around, documented the dens. And at the time that we were hearing cub vocalization, we would make note of that. And then we would wait about 4 or 5 weeks from that time to then immobilize the female, go in, mark the cubs, and at the same time, change her collar, do any maintenance that we needed to do with her. It was a little bit scary at first because they run such a reduced metabolic rate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're barely breathing. Their heart's barely beating. And so we had a veterinarian accompany a lot of our early on entries in the den.
When you say barely, can you quantify that?
Yeah, like 4 breaths per minute.
Okay. Whereas humans are around 12 to 13,
right,
typically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe even less, maybe 3 per minute. And on the heartbeat, can't remember exactly what those figures were, but it was about 35% of what normal up and running would be.
So fascinating.
Yeah. Everything's reduced way down.
Yeah.
Of course, the cubs, you know, they're not in this reduced metabolic function. They're pretty active, quite active. By the time we were handling them, they typically weighed 5 to 7 or 8 pounds.
So cute.
They're amazingly cute. Yeah. And at first we were putting in ear tags, but we actually quit doing that pretty early on. It just was a bit too obtrusive to them. And we went with inserting a microchip in their neck. A much better way to go for identification. Although when they're treed, you know, you don't know if this animal's been handled or not.
Right.
Until you get them in hand.
Yeah.
But through hunter check-in process over time, there was microchip bears showing up, I think as late as 2010.
Hmm.
So this is like, you know, 15, 16 years after the primary capture part of our study.
Where would the microchip go?
On the neck.
Into the muscle?
No, it was just subcutaneous under the skin. And it would go kind of up against the back of the skull.
So would it stay in the dermis? I'm just wondering how it would show up at the check station.
Yeah, and we had scanners.
Okay.
So either at any of the regional offices.
Yeah.
There were scanners. And at the time we were actively doing the study, there was biologists in the field that would have the scanners. You know, we had in the LeGrand office, I don't know, we had a number of them.
Gotcha.
Probably a half dozen scanners. So
yeah,
it was cool. I mean, it was just a really exciting time. The only thing from my perspective was the letdown of how the voters of Oregon opted to vote against hound hunting. And then, because our study went on for years after that vote occurred, Measure 18, and we had to keep our houndsmen motivated, their volunteers, to continue to help us on the study, knowing that they've lost their hunting opportunity with dogs.
Yeah. So what science were you able to present to the voting public to help inform their decision?
Well, we, in 94, nine, was it 94? It must have been 94. The fall, it would have been in the fall of 94 that the vote occurred. So in our capture season of 94, which was technically our second capture season, we were on some local news programs. We were on Northwest Reports was one of the programs. We, when I say we, our study members, myself as a biologist, Ted Craddock as a houndsman, Mark Hingem as our the ultimate supervisor over the project, we had the opportunity to comment on that program, and we took a reporter out in the field. In fact, it was Lars Larson who went out in the field with us. And it was, I thought, fantastic. There's a lot of good talk about, you know, just as you've brought up, the incredible characteristics of bears and how they live and how they fit into the ecological situation. But after that program aired, we got word from the governor's office that we shouldn't be, as biologists working for the state, making statements that are positive about hound hunting, is what it amounted to. That we needed to be totally neutral and only speak about biological elements, which is kind of hard to do when you're working with a bunch of houndsmen. And, you know, they're doing this incredible service of volunteering thousands, literally thousands of hours of their time to find out this important information for bear management.
And it's not cheap to keep hounds all year long.
No.
Or to buy hounds or to train hounds.
Yeah.
You know, one of the biggest misconceptions in hunting is that treeing lions or bobcats is easy if you use dogs.
Yeah.
Like some of the times that I've been the most physically exhausted in my life, and cold and scared and, you know, like all of that have been when I'm chasing lions with dogs.
Yeah.
It can be absolutely, absolutely brutally difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And from a work perspective, you know, myself and my assistant, we're packing around all this capture gear because we needed to leave the houndsmen light and agile and capable to keep up with their dogs.
Yeah.
So it was incredibly taxing.
Yeah.
I was in really good shape then, a lot better than now. But I'll tell you the thing for me, I never was totally comfortable climbing trees.
Yeah.
Especially above 70 feet, big ponderosa pines, and if a bear were to get hung up, but you had to do it.
Right.
But it was a little bit bothersome to me, so I was kind of happy when I was able to discontinue that aspect of it.
I've read that 30 feet is the scariest height.
I can see that, yeah.
And, you know, it gets progressively scarier until you get to 30 feet. And then whether you're 1,000 feet in the air, you know, jumping out of an airplane or rappelling out of a helicopter, like whatever it is, it doesn't. We don't have the capacity to have more fear beyond that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do all the physical things that you need to do in order to be relaxed. In other words, you need to lean back.
Right.
Because, you know, your spurs are in the tree and you're using your climbing rope.
Yep.
with a safety line, but you got to relax and lean back.
Yeah.
It provides the best angle for your spurs, your climbing spurs.
Yeah. So, it's the same way rappelling out of a helicopter.
Yeah.
You've got your rigging on a medium helicopter. It's up in the middle and top of the aircraft and running out to a carabiner on the edge. And you've got to lean back into your harness. And by the time you're doing it for real from a helicopter, you've done it on the ground. You've done it from a tower. Like, you should know that harness, you're not going to fall out of your harness. Like, nothing bad can happen. But boy, does it not feel good to trust all that system for the first time.
It is. It's tough.
I'm interrupting this podcast to bring you a little bit more wildlife biology. What is delayed implantation? Also known as embryonic diapause, it is a reproductive phenomenon observed in certain mammals where the fertilized egg, the blastocyst, temporarily halts its development and does not immediately implant in the uterus. Instead, the development is paused and the blastocyst remains free-floating in the uterus for an extended period of time before implanting and continuing its growth. This phenomenon is a reproductive adaptation that allows the timing of birth to be more favorable for the species. Delayed implantation can be triggered by various environmental factors, such as seasonal changes, availability of resources, or hormonal signals. By delaying the development and implantation of the embryo, animals can time the birth of their offspring to coincide with optimal conditions for their survival. Several mammalian species exhibit delayed implantation, including certain carnivores, marsupials, and some species of whales. In carnivores like bears, for example, delayed implantation allows the female to synchronize the birth of their cubs with a time of year that is ideal so that, she can be in the den at the right phase. And when she's ready to come out of the den, then the grass is about ready and the bear cubs are about the right size. This is why it's so important. During the period of delayed implantation, the blastocyst is maintained in a state of suspended animation. Once the implantation is initiated, normal embryonic development resumes, leading to the eventual birth of the offspring. This reproductive strategy provides certain advantages in terms of reproductive flexibility and adaptability to environmental conditions, ensuring that the young are born when conditions are most favorable for their survival.
And later on in the study, we started looking at some other aspects of bear ecology, one of which was their dens. And a lot of the bears in that Starkey unit were going in top entry tree dens.
So tell me about that.
They were climbing up these big white firs that were basically had some element of hollowness on their inside. A lot of times, if you're out in the forest and you see a big white fir tree that's got a bayonet top, it's had the top blown out of it.
Yep.
And then it's resprouted with a bunch of like Christmas trees that actually provide protection to the top.
Okay.
So these bears are going 50, 60, 75 feet, whatever, up these larger diameter white fir trees, going in that pocket up in the top. And that's where they were denning.
Wow.
And we even had females giving birth to cubs up there.
Sure.
It was not the norm, but it did occur. A lot of the females that were giving birth were in trees, but they were usually in a base entry type of a tree and or a log that had been left in the woods because it had heart rot, and they would be in a hollow log. So when you're out there hunting or whatever in the, late fall or more towards spring, if you look at the entry on those trees that are down and have been sawed, you would see bear hair around the edges.
Wow.
And there'd probably be a bear in there.
A lot of the bear dens I've been around are, crevices and rocks, little caves and stuff like that in the canyons. And I'm always amazed at the amount of grass that they'll gather in the fall to create bedding and presumably to plug that entryway up a little bit.
Those are likely female bears.
Likely females. Yeah. Interesting.
The male bears, a boar's den. I mean, I think this is where it comes from.
Yeah.
Because they just did not have the same quality of den as a female bear, particularly one that was going to give birth. They would pack all that bedding material in to make it more cozy for the cubs. But males, they just climb in a hole and make it work.
Yeah. But females, they need some interior decorating.
Yeah.
Yeah, some
right.
Feng got, shui. Yeah.
Yeah. Some furnishings.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. What else did you learn about the denning? Were they traveling a long ways from where they were living in the fall to where they wanted to den?
Well, you know, you go into these studies, you read literature and what people are finding or thinking, and then you try and apply that to your situation or say, well, that doesn't fit our situation. And I think that a lot of what we were seeing was novel and new. The tree use was much higher than the norm on what we were seeing. Mm-hmm. And it's felt, and I think it's been pretty well documented in Yellowstone and other parts of the Rockies, the bears will den and pre-position themselves for an early spring. And when they come out, there's good stuff to eat that's kind of readily available while they're getting their physiological function in order, up and running. But we had some bears that, and particularly males, that were in the top of the Elkhorn Mountains and literally in the peaks of the Elkhorns. And when they left the den, they popped through a bunch of snow, went right down to the valley and started eating the same green up as a bear that might have dug a hole right by the green up. So there wasn't a lot of rhyme or reason, except for the fact that female bears seem, particularly those that had cubs or went in knowing they were going to give birth, with their delayed implantation process, you know, they apparently would have some signal that they knew they were pregnant, and they would have by far the best dens, and they would have the bedding material. They would usually be connected with a tree, which usually meant it was going to be a warmer den than stone. Some of them would dig holes, but almost always somehow connected with a tree.
Hmm. For those who don't know what the Elkhorn Mountains are, describe what that trip would be like. That is not insignificant.
No, it isn't insignificant. And basically, what we were saying was the male bears that might have been along the Grand Ronde River, just out of Le Grand, in the late summer and fall, maybe taking advantage of riparian berries at that time of year, they would start moving back up into more upland situations. And in the years we were doing the study, there was a lot of cow elk hunting going on. Mm-hmm. And if some of them were on to gut piles, they would stay longer in that zone where elk were being shot to scavenge the remains of the elk carcasses. Mm-hmm. But then before the snows got deep, like, say, Thanksgiving-ish, they would go up by Anthony Lake ski area in some cases and go to some den site that they obviously had known about, because it was pretty much a beeline.
You're talking about like 8,000 feet of elevation gain over the course of 40 miles?
Yeah, right.
That's crazy.
And when they went to do it, they didn't dilly-dally. They just went.
Yeah.
But that's in the case of males that are staying out longer.
Yeah.
Now, which is typically the mature males. Younger males and females seem to do this more methodical approach, in that they would get around their den site and do what we were calling localizing, hanging out near the den. They pick the den, and they might be out as much as they're in the hole for a week or two. And then you'll get that dump of snow or that temperature's dropping 10 degrees at night, and they'll go in for good.
Is there always a correlation between age and size? Do boars get bigger as they get older?
Yes and no. By and large, you know, their bone structure, of course, is at the maximum as they're older. Their mass, I think, is very much a product of their feeding behavior.
When would you say their bone structure reaches maturity?
Five, probably.
That's about when
five.
They have growth plates like a human does, and like
sure, yeah. And I think the head size it would probably be the best barometer of when that's completed.
Yeah,
you know, it's your biggest bears, black bears, in our part of the country in the Blue Mountains, are probably going to be in that 8 to 12 year range. After 12, they might make it for another 4, 5, 6, or 7 years, but they're not going to change in size. It's fully developed at that point.
We killed a 296-pound bear this year in that area, and that was a live weight, hanging weight on a good scale. That's a really big bear for this area.
It is.
Yeah, it really is. We haven't measured that skull yet. It was a boar, and you know, obviously, we don't have the tooth data back. But I did get the tooth back for this big lion over here, 14 years old.
Yeah, I can believe it.
That's a old tom.
That's an old tom.
Yeah,
and got good teeth for that age.
Yeah,
really
does.
In pretty darn amazingly good shape.
Yeah.
Well, the heaviest bear that we weighed was 340. It seems like, and that would be a late summer, early fall.
August bear.
Yeah, you got it.
Yep.
August bear. Maximum size.
Critters are fat in August, man.
Yeah, they are. Yep.
You know, the delayed implantation, am I saying that correctly?
Yes, you are.
I think that is so fascinating.
Yep.
We talked about it a little bit last week, but I want to talk about it some more.
Yep.
And I'm going to give you my understanding of this, and you can tell me all the ways that I'm wrong.
Okay.
Okay. So these bears are in the rut in June. That's primary breeding time. So that's when the boar is going to breed a sow. And that's when we're going to get sperm connected to an egg.
Yep.
And it could have sperm from multiple boars attached to multiple eggs, right? If she gets bred by more than one boar, she could have, in the future, she could be raising cubs from multiple boars in the same batch. Are they called litters?
Yeah.
Okay. Same litter. Now, what do we call that when we just have a sperm and an egg? Is that a zygote?
Yep. It's fertilized.
Okay. So we have a fertilized egg that just floats around the uterus.
I think it actually attaches to the uterine wall.
It does.
Yeah. But it doesn't, in essence, develop until the month of October.
So
later in October, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if she's getting enough calories in the day and has good enough body condition, then that embryo can start to develop. If she's not, then it's just the easiest self-abortion that an animal could have. No stress in that abortion process whatsoever. She's just not going to raise cubs that year. But then you have this relatively short, like, actual gestation of around 60 days. And, you know, the cubs are being born right when this podcast is coming out. You know, end of January, early February timeframe. And they're about the size of a pop can, cute little thing. That is so incredible to me. And it's incredibly rare within the animal kingdom.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It's the only one in North America that does that, or the bears.
But if we think about why they would do that, in the spring, in June, they have ample amounts of grass. You know, elk calves are abundant at that time as well. So two of the things they love eating the most are abundant and available when they're going through this high energy output time period of breeding. Sows are defending her cubs from boars that are trying to kill them. Like, they've got a high energy output at that time. In the fall, when they go into hyperphagia and really want to stack the calories on, they are not having to deal with that extra stress like the deer and elk are. I mean, it's so smart. It is smart to be able to do that.
Yeah. And then the whole process of converting fat into milk.
Yes.
Which is the other thing that's happening. And if you think about it, like our average litter size, it was 2.3 was our average litter size.
Okay.
So basically in between 2 and 3.
That checks out with what I see in the spring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're raising, so they're giving up from their body enough milk, enough fluid to bring these cubs up to the weight of 8 pounds, say, on the average.
Wow.
For at least two of them.
Sure.
Might be a little bit less if they've got three. But that's just an incredible exchange of energy converting from fat into high-protein milk.
Yeah. Not just turning fat into like a heat exchange of energy, yeah. but also the liquid element of
right.
that too.
Yep.
It's so amazing. Like,
it
what
is.
An incredible animal.
Yeah, they
what
really
an incredible
are.
Animal.
Yeah, and of all the wildlife research I've done in 35, 40 years, I would say without question, the most amazing animal is the female bear.
Yeah. What else impresses you about her?
Intelligence.
Yeah.
And when, like I said, we were doing dog pursuit, of course, from the standpoint of dog pursuit, we were trying to be considerate of a female with cubs and not chase them right as they're coming out of the den.
Mm-hmm.
But like about, say, late midsummer, late June into July, that time frame, we would tree the sow to see what her cub numbers were, particularly in the event that we'd been in her den, which we had a lot of them that had cubs.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that she had three or she had two. And then we would tree them to see, does she still have three? There's a little bit of survival information that's pretty important.
What did you find?
And the majority of them, they survived quite well. And as we treed them, I guess here's where the amazing thing is that the female bear would usually be by a security tree, everything's striking distance, but she herself a lot of times would not go up that tree. She'd pop the cubs up.
Right.
She'd go on a big chase, take the dogs out on this big run, might even bay up a time or two, and she would come back and tree within like 100 yards or less of the cubs.
Yeah.
So she was there to communicate with them. But that, to me, is a display of intellect, intelligence.
Yeah. And we see animals, lots of different animals do something like that. You know, killdeer,
right.
coyotes, mallards.
Right.
Lots of animals will, the mother will, you know, stash her young and then take off,
yeah.
cause a ruckus in doing so and try and draw those predators away. But not necessarily to the point of coming back within range of communication, which brings up another interesting thing. How do you find that bears communicate? Like they make a lot of sounds.
They do. Yep. There's, of course, cubs. It's, you know, they're squalling. It's more noticeable. But the sow will make grunts and almost like a chirping sound when she's communicating back to the cubs. And all the pursuit we did of this, we didn't do a huge amount, but it was at least a couple dozen. We never had an occurrence of dogs catching cubs.
Good.
Yeah. So we were careful about how we went about it. But I think we were careful and she was smart.
Yeah.
The fact that she was smart, I think, was a big part of that.
With the with bears getting into trash, my by far favorite line about that is somebody asked why we can't make a trash can that's bear-proof.
Yeah.
And the answer is that there's considerable overlap between the smartest bear and the dumbest human.
Yeah.
So if we make a bear-proof trash can, people aren't going to be able to figure out how to get their trash in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. We had, you know, getting back to your comment about the urban-suburban adaptation of bears, I had a call. It was fairly late in the study. It was probably, 96, I think. We had done a lot of capture and had a call from the regional supervisor to assist the district biologist with a bear in Union that was in a tree and there was getting to be a lot of people around. And so I went there to do the capture, and the district bio went there to control the crowd, basically. And I couldn't believe the scene that I came upon, which was this huge male bear. And we didn't weigh this one, but I'm sure it was around that 350-pound range, in a little, like a cherry tree, and had been treed by this Chihuahua cross, little miniature dog. But the bear was trying to get to the dog's food, which was on a back porch, is what it amounted to.
Mm.
And the dog was there and did a bunch of barking and it treed. So then you get people moving in, and there was like 20 or 25 people around this bear. And he's getting a little bit sick of this situation because he's been up there for probably 60, 90 minutes or something like that by the time I arrived. And then the local police show up, and they're not used to these sorts of scenarios, so they've got their shotguns and slugs ready. And my job was really relatively easy. I just was loading up a dart gun and was going to shoot it when people were not behind where I was shooting.
And you didn't want to arc some telazol into a teenager?
Right. But the district bio was doing, you know, no, you guys, don't get overzealous with your shotguns to the police officers. Mm. And then to the crowd, you know, you need to back off a bit. Don't be in so tight. That's putting pressure on this bear, and it's going to have to react.
Right.
So we darted it. We took it up to Anthony Lakes in that vicinity, and we let that thing go. And was it 2 days?
About an hour and a half drive.
Yeah, hour and a half drive anyway.
Yeah.
You know, from LeGrand, yeah, a good hour and a half.
Yeah.
2 days later, it was back. It wasn't at that house, but it was within a quarter mile
sure.
of it. And it ultimately ended up going in a den just out of town a little ways.
Now, will they use the same den year after year?
Yes and no. We had that occur for sure, particularly with some of the female bears. And tree dens, basic tree dens, were the most frequently reused. They're just the perfect substrate. You know, they've dug it out, have a small entryway that they can just squeeze through. Everything about them is fairly ideal. They hold heat well.
Mm-hmm.
But those would get reused. A lot of the cave situations that the male bears were using and or ones that they had dug at the last, right before they, you know, decided it's time to go in the hole, those would not be reused. So there was variation, but a good high-quality den would have a tendency for reuse.
Do you think they'd get smelly? Did they get fleas?
The parasite aspect, we didn't really notice that, except for some of the bears, particularly the female bears from lice, would lose a lot of hair around their eyes, around their face.
Mm.
And yeah, I gave that some thought before crawling in the den, but
yeah.
I never seemed to pick anything up from that. I was always aware and on the lookout for picking up lice.
What about aspect? Did you find that they preferred to den in a north, south?
It seemed like they tended away from a north aspect.
Okay.
It was the tendency just because they're cold.
Yeah.
Probably a tendency, I would say, towards an east aspect.
Yeah.
If there was an average.
Gotcha.
On that.
Yeah.
But the denning stuff was amazing.
Sure.
I mean, to me, you know, they're going all this length of time without eating. They come out. They've got to get rid of this fecal plug. Mm-hmm. Of which sometimes we would find them, you know, right around the den, the fecal plug.
What is that?
It's basically a consolidated mass of what they last ate.
Okay.
In a lot of cases, we would see ants just packed into this little black disc. Sometimes there would be some other material, elk hair or whatever, depending upon, you know, what it was they last fed on. We didn't find enough of them. You know, we found, I don't know, half dozen or so.
Do you think that they ate something on purpose to create that
I
plug?
I always wondered about that.
You're choosing your constipation yeah. for a few months, you know?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Berries aren't going to cut it.
Right.
Like, you've got to find something that will do
solid.
The job.
Yeah. If there was an average from what we saw, not a very big sample size, I would say it was hair-based and insect-based.
Interesting.
You know?
Which, if it was insect-based, you would think that that had to happen earlier in the year, you know? You're not really going to find ants in November.
Well, you dig up logs, you do.
Yeah.
You
well, know, I suppose, yeah.
Get in the logs.
They're dormant in there.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, what you just mentioned, the dormant aspect.
Right.
Makes the ants a little more vulnerable.
Sure.
If they're active, like say in August, they're going to scurry when their nest gets dislodged. So
if you could time travel back to 1994 and you could have a platform that the governor wasn't censoring you on and you could talk to all of Oregon's voters, what would you say to them?
Well,
as a scientist,
I would say that hound hunting is a very important management tool, and it can always be regulated back. It's not like it's wanton, willy-nilly, and that's something that so many people don't understand, that, you know, there's a permit process. There's going to be X number of people out there taking X number of bears, and it provides an opportunity for harvest that is reliable.
Mm-hmm.
It's perhaps the most reliable method. And I think...
And selective.
I was just going to say, and I think in a lot of cases, the most selective.
Yeah.
Because we had one female bear that we documented gaining 94 pounds in the course of the year. And she was a calf eater. Mm. And she went from, I can't remember what it was. It was like 190-something or 180-something. She's a big female. To 290. It was like an unusually big female. And if you saw that bear, you would say, that's a male. I'm going to shoot it. And she was one that really cranked out the cubs, too.
Yeah.
So the probability of shooting a female bear that really has cubs is pretty high.
Hmm.
I mean, anybody would make that mistake thinking, heck, that's a good boar.
Sure.
So, but as a houndsman, you know, you put it in a tree, you get a good look at it, you can see that it's lactating. So there's the opportunity for selectivity.
Yeah.
And I guess it's just another tool. And bear hunting is, it's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it provides a real challenging opportunity, whatever your method, be it with hounds or spot and stalk and or calling,
mm-hmm.
which is done a lot now, is calling pretty
yeah.
effectively. Which gives a little bit of an opportunity for selectivity if you call.
Yeah, you tend to get animals closer, and you can, lay a better eyeball on them than looking at them across the canyon.
Yeah, yeah. Males have a little more of a tendency to be predatory, so they're going to be more apt to respond to a fox pro call and or a mouth call. They're going to be more apt to do that.
Right. Which electric calls are legal for calling bears in Oregon.
Yeah, they are.
Yep. Baiting is another great way to be selective about the bear that you're going to hunt. And there's a couple things with bait. There's the closeness, but today we have a picture of that bear, right?
Mm-hmm.
For every bait, there's probably a camera.
Yep.
So you know which bears are coming in, and you've got a good idea of which bear you're planning on hunting, and you can recognize it when it shows up, and you can be so much more selective. What does a healthy age structure look like? Because that's what we're sort of talking about here for folks who are maybe not understanding. Like, why would it matter? It matters because you want to have a bear population that has, so many at different ages in order for it to be healthy and mm-hmm. to really maximize its benefit to the ecosystem.
Right.
So what does age structure look like in a healthy way?
Well, of course, the habitat situation is going to be somewhat variable, but from a management perspective, you want your age structure to be 3.5 years or greater of age. And from the standpoint of what that looks like in the field, that's a mature animal.
Right.
Is what it amounts to.
Yeah.
So that's in that age node of, say, 3.5 years is something that would be generated from analyzing 24 or 30 bears that were harvested and look at their average age. That's the index that's used for that.
How old is a sow before she can have cubs?
About that age.
About 3.5.
Yeah.
Okay.
And sometimes at 3, but primarily in that
wow.
3 to 4 age bracket. And we had some that, we had marked as yearling bears that, and radio collared, that I know there was at least one, maybe two, that didn't give birth until they were 5.
Hmm.
But probably the average is in between 3 and 4.
I've seen some tiny sows
yeah.
in the Frank with cubs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. And those would more than likely be younger animals. Yeah. And that's something else I'd like to make comment about is dispersal. And we felt we were able to do work with dispersal because we had that mobile capture opportunity with the use of dogs.
What does that mean, dispersal?
It's for a subadult animal that's approaching adulthood. They get a drive to move, migrate, leave the area. And if you look at it biologically, there's a lot of genetic viability type reasons that they will do that. So you don't have this inbreeding phenomena. And males really disperse. That's the one thing we found. We underestimated their dispersal capability. Hmm. And on the females, there was a real strong tendency to set up shop, so to speak, somewhere within their mother's home range of, say, a 35 to 40 square mile area. She will carve out a niche. And over time, you know, her mother will pass away and she will enlarge her home range area. But those young males, we had a number, and they always wanted to disperse, in our study case, to the southwest for whatever reason. Hmm. Probably habitat corridors or who knows what would send them in that direction. Mm-hmm. But the majority did go to the south and the west, and we had them go from basically LeGrand to John Day, which is a pretty significant dispersal.
Hundreds of miles.
And it was, and we did not have GPS technology at that time. So for me, flying is like, that damn bear, I can't catch up with him. So you got to go way high to get this diffuse, soft signal, beep, beep, beep. And then you've got to figure out which direction and track it down and then hope that it's staying fairly nearby. And then the next day, round up the houndsmen and go down there and use the telemetry to get in close and get them treed and get their collar off.
Yeah.
Because obviously you don't want to leave a growing bear with the collar.
Right.
We had these breakaway mechanisms built into them and they were fairly reliable, but not 100%.
Yeah.
So you could potentially have an animal get constricted in the neck and ultimately choke.
Yeah. You don't want that.
No.
What's something that people often get wrong about bears?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the people are more fearful of bears than is warranted. Mm. That's something that I would say. Black bears. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying grizzly bears. Not to say that they shouldn't be respectful of black bears, because I have seen situations where they've surprised me with their suddenness of anger or change of demeanor.
Right.
But by and large, they want to get away from people. Mm-hmm. Unless they're like in this Tahoe situation that you referred to earlier, where they see people so regularly, they don't have that built-in mechanism to be fearful.
Yeah.
I think that that is very important, that bears, one, are wild, two, are kept honest, which hunting does for us.
Right.
It keeps them honest. And their diet is something that's natural and not unnatural, as in the situation in suburbia or these semi-urban environments, where I think if you really looked at their diet, it would be probably 70% things that were man-produced products, dog food, etc.
Every aggressive black bear encounter I've personally had has been at the end of August or the beginning of September.
Yeah.
And I've seen them, you know, smell people and run away, you know, in that scent they're catching. And in one example was over a mile away in the springtime. So like that's the fear response at that point.
Right.
But change the time of year and you can start having a lot more aggressive encounters. And I find that, you know, anecdotally from other people as well, you know, I hear, hey, I, you know, had a black bear charge me this week, and it tends to be last week of August, first week of September.
Interesting. I think that there's pulses, nodes of time like you're talking about. Another one's breeding season.
Yeah.
And from a research perspective, when we were walking in on radio-colored bears, mm-hmm. I felt that that's where we would get the most signals, the woofing type sounds. Jaw popping is another signal.
Right.
They certainly can be aggressive. Yeah. There's no question about it.
But right.
I think that it is probably coming from the male because, you know, they've probably worked hard to have this opportunity with the female, and they don't want to give it up.
Right.
And don't really want to be disturbed,
quite
frankly.
Yeah. So, from everything that you studied and in all of your experiences in your life, spending so much time in the wild, what information from your studies do you think is most helpful to you as a bear hunter or would be helpful to other bear hunters?
Knowing their diet.
Yeah.
And particularly for spring bear hunters.
So let's dip into that a little bit.
Okay. Well, they're pretty oriented towards tubers and succulent green vegetation.
What's a tuber?
It would be lomatium, which would be some sort of it's a plant that has a bulb.
Okay.
An onion, wild onions in this complex. The Snake River Breaks country has a lot of onion in it.
Yeah.
That's one of the preferred. And the lomatium or biscuit root.
Okay.
It's a root that has quite a bit of starch to it. The onions have that starchiness, but I think they're after the flavor.
Yeah.
They taste good, but some of both.
Gotcha.
So I think, you know, looking for excavation areas from the spring bear hunting perspective is really a wise thing to do for a knowledgeable bear hunter.
Gotcha.
And identifying where those plants are growing. And, you know, in the fall, the flip side would be riparian berries and or huckleberries. You know, this past year in some areas is a great huckleberry year. Yeah, and that's going to create an attractant. So vegetation, food attractants are big. And or, you know, the fawning, calving, those areas, calving grounds is another thing. If for where seasons go long enough to capture that, like the
Idaho
seasons do.
I'd love to see our spring bear season get loosened up, frankly, like, you know, taking 4 preference points to draw a spring bear tag.
Right.
It seems so silly to me that, you know, you have to wait, you know, every 3 or 4 years you get to hunt them in the spring. So that means from, you know, April 1st or April 15th until May 31st. So June and July are off limits, but August 1st, everybody can get 2 tags to hunt the whole state every single year. It just seems silly to me that spring is so restricted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's easier to find them in the spring. I get that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a lot of it is that trying to be a little more protective of the resource, so to speak. And it's an old thing that's sort of built into Western states' management schemes with some exceptions.
Yeah.
You know, Idaho's definitely one of those, but Idaho has
Montana's over the counter.
Right.
Idaho's over the counter.
Wyoming.
Wyoming's over the counter. Washington's completely lost its marbles.
Right. Colorado, somewhere in between, maybe. I don't. Colorado, maybe more like Oregon.
I don't know if Colorado has a spring season.
I don't think they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't know a lot about Colorado.
Yeah.
So don't hate me if I'm wrong. Yeah. I would love to see our season extended until June 15th.
Yeah.
It would be really helpful, especially in these areas where mule deer are struggling so hard, to be able to hunt bears that were specifically targeting those fawning grounds.
Yeah.
It would be wonderful to be able to target those bears in particular, and that's exactly what hunters would do.
Right. Yeah. And that selectivity would accomplish a needed management action.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see that for sure.
My understanding is that the way we take bear populations now is based off of hunter success.
Mm-hmm.
And hunter success tends to be, you know, you get the same percentage of hunters who are successful given the number of tags. We haven't changed the number of tags. So we have the same percentage that are harvesting every year. So if this is our data set, you would think that the bear population is static.
Yeah.
That seems crazy to me too. In this world that we live in today, is there a better way to go out and understand our bear population?
Yeah. Well, one of the things we did was try and come up with a monitoring method that could be repeated fairly easily. And it was using dogs.
Yeah.
And we were looking at our study area, strikes per linear unit. In other words, the dogs indicating they smell bear
right
along these routes. And we got a good publication in a peer-reviewed International Bear Association magazine for that work we did. But the problem is organizing or coordinating a pool of houndsmen, particularly in our state, where the only ones that can really do it are agents,
right,
and they're few and far between. So we don't really have that tool. So ultimately, you get back to hunter harvest as being the primary measure that you can assess a population. And then from that, it's not just the number of harvested, the age structure is going to be the critical thing. So that's kind of the way that we've been forced to manage.
Yeah.
And we've gradually worked in spring bear hunting. When we were doing our research in the Starkey unit, there was no spring season. But by the time the year, I think it was in the year 2000, we recommended, this population can handle some spring bear hunting. And it started with 50 tags, and then I think it went to 100. And so there has been this gradual opening up. So I don't think it's out of the question to extend the dates like what you're talking about. Unfortunately, we don't have a real reliable tool, population assessment-wise, to help support that, other than age structure.
Right. Okay. Last question is about color phase.
Yeah.
I think this is another thing that bear hunters and, bear enthusiasts largely misunderstand. I find it fascinating that the cinnamon bear got its own species.
Yeah.
Or subspecies, that's just another color phase.
Yeah.
But that's the lump or splitter thing. We won't get into that. How do you see color changing as a bear ages? And do you see many older bears that are still blonde, for example?
Female bears, it seems like, will maintain or hold their color, their pelage, whatever they started with into later life more, for whatever reason. Males seem to transition from being perhaps a blonde into a brown. Mm. And then you get these black-legged brown bears. There's all these sort of transitional phases in between that occur. It's interesting that the more arid parts of our northeast corner of the state are where the lighter phases occur.
Yeah.
And I think some of that's just environmental adaptation over time. If you're black and you're in Hell's Canyon, you're going to be pretty darn hot.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Yeah.
In our study area, we ran a preponderance towards black, but not huge. There was a lot of brown phase in the Starkey unit. And not very many blonde or cinnamon. I think we had one that was truly cinnamon, maybe two that were blonde out of a pretty big subset of, 157 bears.
Yeah.
But most of them were black, and black with a white patch was pretty
on their chest.
Common on their chest. Yeah.
I've still never killed a black bear in Oregon.
Yeah.
I've got to go out of state to do that, and I think they're so beautiful and special, and the black, the rich black on a black bear is just such a beautiful color.
Yeah, it's high sheen.
Yeah, it glimmers.
They glimmer. Yeah, they're shiny. But some of the brown phases I think are really cool too, and you can really see where people would misidentify a big male black bear that's brown for a grizzly.
Sure.
And in a lot of cases, they look like they have a hump.
Yeah. Well, they do have a hump in a lot of cases. Yeah. You know, it's just, it's a tricky thing. And as that grizzly population continues to expand its range, we're going to have mistakes.
Yeah.
We're straight up going to have people that are very well-intentioned that shoot a black bear in a place that's not known to have grizzlies, and they're going to go and see that thing and be like, holy crap,
that's a grizzly.
We just shot a grizzly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what the hell do they do? Right? If somebody does that out here in Hell's Canyon and, you know, they shoot a bear across a canyon and go over there and its claws are 4 inches long, what the hell are they going to do?
Yeah.
Like, bring it in and get roasted alive in the media and everything else?
Yeah.
Or kick the thing down the hillside, which is the wrong thing to do. You know, they're in a bad situation.
Yeah, they are in a bad situation. But I think honesty is the right avenue in that situation, and just say, hey, I couldn't tell when I shot it, and please forgive me, but isn't this interesting that we're seeing grizzlies showing up in Oregon? They obviously are coming down the Salmon River corridor in order to then come up the Snake and then be in Hell's Canyon.
I would think that if, and I don't know this to be true, but I'm going to find out. I would think that if you called one of our state troopers who's a game official and told them what happened, said, I am requesting anonymity to the greatest extent possible for this to protect myself from all the crazies, I bet that they would honor that.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if it was previously published that there might be a bear and well distributed, that information,
right.
You know, there's known to be at the mouth of the Omnaha as an example.
Yeah.
A grizzly sighting. That could be different, but just by chance, there's no way that person should be held accountable.
Yeah.
It's, and particularly if it's it's probably going to be a smaller 2 to 3 year old grizzly, because those are the dispersers.
Yeah.
That's going to show up. It's going to be right in the size class of a male black bear.
Well, I mean, I'm afraid that that's how it's going to happen in Oregon. That's how it happened in Idaho, if I remember right. Idaho said, no, we don't have grizzlies. We don't have grizzlies.
Right.
And then somebody showed up with a dead one. They're like, what do you call this? And they're like, hey, we've got grizzlies. Don't do that again. You know? Gosh, I think that we probably need to get ahead of that a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe start doing some bear ID classes and differences.
Yeah.
Instead of just like a random line drawing in the hunting regulations.
Yeah.
Like we could do a better job.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And boy, it's tough though. You know, even at as close as 200 to 300 yards.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to be able to see the claws.
No.
In most cases.
No, it's extremely tough.
It would be extremely tough.
Yeah. And, yeah, I did not get 100% on my bear ID class that I had to take in Montana.
Yeah.
Because they make you take one there, and I don't think anybody gets 100%. There's
probably not. There's some tricky ones.
Yeah.
For a reason.
There's a black grizzly in there that I think a lot of people get wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of small for being a grizz, too. But
yeah. Which the grizzlies in Montana are way smaller than what people think they are.
And the grizzly we're going to see here are going to be small, too.
No, it's going to be a 200-pound bear. It's going to look like the rest of them.
I know it.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to say, just as a final, is, you know, people, their misidentification on bears. Mm. I mentioned the risk factor. I would say the size factor is huge, too.
Okay.
And a 200-pound male bear is a big bear, and a lot of people think they're 400.
Yeah.
They very consistently almost double what their actual weight is.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to work with the houndsman, get them in a tree, have to decide, and I would usually talk to one of the houndsmen, primarily Ted Craddock, because he had the most experience. What do you think the weight of that is? I got to load this dart.
Right.
And we almost always would start out a little high and then work our way back.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably not 160. It's probably more like 120-pound bear.
Yeah.
But most hunters are going to go the other way and say, no, it's 220 and maybe even 250 when it's 160.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, if you're doing your math for packing a bear out too, their guts are way smaller than they are on a deer or elk.
Yeah.
So when you gut a bear, it doesn't lose the weight like an ungulate does.
Yeah.
Their digestive system is just a lot smaller. So if you're packing out a bear, you're going to pack out way more from a 200-pound bear than you will from a 200-pound deer.
Very true.
Yeah,
very true.
And it is so tough. If they're out there on the hillside, you know, they're all the same shape. And there's some bad information out there, frankly, about estimating bear size. Like, people will say, well, if he has big ears, then it's a small bear. Or they'll say, well, if it looks like its belly's hanging low, it's a big bear.
Yeah.
I've found both of those things to be very wrong. I just shot a bear in North Carolina that was like 12 feet away from me. Like, I got a good look at this bear and it had huge ears. And I thought, you know, this isn't that big of a bear. You know, it could not have been closer to me.
Yeah.
And that was a 300-pound, 6-foot bear.
Wow.
You know, it was a big bear.
Yeah.
So it is a really difficult thing to do. Don't beat yourself up if you shoot a bear and it's a different size than what you thought it was.
Yeah.
And unless you're putting them on a scale, there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't know. I don't know what he weighed.
Yeah.
Because most people don't have scales and will never weigh a bear in their life, even if they shoot 100 of them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really okay to say, I don't know.
Yeah. 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 Foot size. There is a correlation we found, particularly with the male bears, a 5 to 5.5 inch track that's across the front.
How wide the front track is.
Right.
Yeah.
Is characteristic of a bear that's going to be 250 pounds or more.
Yep.
And but that's kind of a generalization. But that, as a, I guess, a reference, when you shoot one, you can measure the pad.
Yeah.
And get some kind of an idea, ballpark figure.
Or if you're tracking them in the mud, you know, what kind of bear you're dealing with. Yep. The Alaska guys will often say that the width of that pad in inches is equal to the length of the bear in feet. So if he's a 7.5 inch wide track, they're going to call that a 7.5 foot bear.
Right. Yeah. And for us in our world here, a 5 inch track is going to be a big male bear.
For sure.
Never saw a female, even that female that weighed 290, did not have a 5 inch pad.
Man, so she was gaining
a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And she was, almost we called her the calf eater.
In a year.
Yeah, and she was in the prime calving area of the LeGrand watershed.
Yeah.
Which is quite a factory for elk, or was, particularly in that time.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. How many calves does it take to gain 100 pounds?
Gosh, a lot.
Yeah. A pile of them.
Yeah. But then there was other bears that would coast along at 130 pounds as a female, and we would track them, and their poop all through that same time period when calving was going on would all be grass vegetation based.
Yeah.
So it was a learned behavior.
Yeah.
For them to be that predatory. And she must have come from a long line of carnivorous black bears is what it amounts to.
Yeah, so folks, if you are interested in hunting bears for the purpose of helping out an ungulate population, really consider calling as a tactic and focus on that. You know, if you can, early June, if you can't, late May time frame.
Yep.
And, you know, call those animals in, and if they're coming into a fawn or a calf elk distress sound, then that is the individual that, you know, you want to take out, because it's going to provide that space in the ecosystem for those fawns and calves to survive.
Yeah. True. Very good point. And it probably wouldn't hurt to have some bear spray, because you might be surprised what you call in, and you ultimately get one you don't want to shoot.
Yeah.
But it is on the hunt.
Yeah.
It's a 110-pound bear. You don't really want to shoot it, but it's in predatory mode. And you might have to squirt it. You might have to spray it.
I say shoot it. All righty, Jim. Well, this has been fun.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your knowledge. So much of what occurs with wildlife biologists and science stays in that bottle.
Yeah.
And it never makes it out. And the wildlife biologists who are active and still working in the field today, they're so afraid of saying something that's wrong that they're unwilling to talk about their professions, and they just end up preaching to the choir, and it stays within their own little
small
ecosystem.
Group. Yeah.
And we're going to continue to see wildlife issues make it to the ballot. And, you know, it's so critical that we talk about actual science and what people have found. And I really appreciate your willingness to do that here today.
Yeah. Well, thank you, James.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be able to do it.
All righty. Bye, everybody.
Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work and the environment and all the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it. And just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and you know, we're just getting started.